Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm feeling very flamboyant.
No.
And this is because the paintings of the artists we are meeting today, mm-hmm. we've actually come over the bridge from Manhattan. We're in New York.
Yeah.
And we've come to Brooklyn.
Bushwick.
To Bushwick in Brooklyn.
Correct.
Thank you. And we're currently in a beautiful, very intimate studio surrounded by many, many paintings, because the artist we are meeting today is about to have an incredible solo exhibition at the Whitney in New York. And therefore, we've come at the perfect time.
The body of work is evolving in front of our eyes.
There are so many paintings. There's about, I don't know, 15 works or something here. And they're all of different scales. So some of them are really intimate and tiny, and then others are much larger with group scenes of different friends. And friendship is a big kind of theme in the work.
Yeah.
And also intimacy and tenderness and love and kind of camaraderie.
Yes.
And also this idea of queer friendship, which is a funny coincidence because you and I have our own queer friendship.
We do have a very queer friendship, Rob.
And the kind of uniqueness of that. Mm-hmm. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Salman Tor.
Thank you for having me, guys.
Thanks
for
having me.
Of course. How are you today, Salman?
Good, good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Where have we found you at this point in your studio?
So I'm kind of at the tail end of what I was doing for the Whitney, and there's one more work left to do.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the studio is not this full, so you guys have come at a very, very good time.
Yeah, it's thank you.
I know, I feel like often when we've gone to studios, we either get there just as they're about to have an exhibition, so everything's left.
Yeah.
And like last night we did an interview in Brooklyn as well, and the studio had like one new painting or, you know, a series of new things, but it was all blank canvases.
Yeah.
So it's really a pleasure to be here with... Yeah. You know, all of these works surrounding us.
So did you know for the Whitney show, when you got offered that, what you wanted to do, how many paintings you wanted to show and the theme?
I had a pretty good idea because at any given time, I feel like I have about like 20 pictures in me.
So on the go. Oh, in you?
So, I mean, I think about images that I want to work on almost months or even a year ahead. They start like fermenting in my head. And they're kind of recurring images.
Yeah.
And then I sort of make an imaginary little sketch of them.
Yeah.
So, you know, they happen kind of organically, one after the other. One image kind of gives birth to the other one, to the next one. So I knew thematically what I was going to do. But it was a little bit hands-on because, when I don't have a show or when I have more time to produce a show, I can do whatever the hell I want to. And so, you know, for the Whitney, they needed, you know, it was like, we needed a list of sketches. There was a plan.
Oh, right. You had to submit. Like...
Yeah, so, I mean, the sketches were already in my diary, which is here somewhere. And so, you know, we chose the ones, like, together. So, some of the sketches I had to fight for a little bit because I wanted those to be, those images to be in the show.
Uh-huh. Do you sketch every day? Is that something you do?
I try to. I used to do that a lot more as a kid because I grew up, I went to a kind of an all-boys prep school, very kind of sporty.
In Lahore, in
Pakistan. Lahore, in Pakistan.
Right.
And, you know, so I did not like cricket. I was very effeminate. I wanted to draw and paint. And so I didn't have very many friends in the beginning. And so drawing was a way of kind of making friends for me.
Really?
Yeah, I made friends with my drawing. Like I had little, like, you know, foolish little characters that had voices.
Voices for them as well. And like,
exactly.
You so animated
that was
them.
One of my earliest embarrassing memory is my father standing behind me, sort of like he's sort of giggling at like, because I was sort of drawing and giving voices to these little...
Wow. So you would animate them as you created them.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you still do that?
Yeah. I mean, not with the same enthusiasm, yeah, hopefully, but...
but like this painting in front of us now you're looking at, could you imagine the voice of these people that are in the room?
This is, I feel like as I grew up, like the images did become a little more sophisticated in the sense that I imagine like silence more in that picture, okay, than voices. The noise is sort of created with the kind of energy of the brushwork. That to me is that, I mean, I guess it's like white, not green noise in this.
Right.
But in a lot of these new works that I'm doing, there is either like a, I guess like the soundtrack would be like a pop song in someone's apartment,
uh-huh,
or a great silence, actually.
Yes, I hear music when you see the scenes of camaraderie and people celebrating. It feels, yeah, like they've spilled out of a club and ended up,
right,
back at your apartment.
Right.
And then they've put on Lady Gaga or...
But you had a work that was called Time After Time, which made me think of Cyndi Lauper.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's such a kind of evocative song.
Yeah, I mean, because I grew up watching Romy and Michelle with my friends.
Really?
Yeah. So that was like a big kind of song, number that meant a lot to us. And, you know, it is a story of friendship as well. And that is a theme that I like to focus on.
Friendship.
Friendships among... queer people of color or otherwise who are just, you know, who have intellectual and artistic pursuits and exchange ideas and have a kind of an unorthodox sense of family.
Well, I was talking to Rob about this because there's a writer called Armistead Maupin and he's written a book called Logical Family. So it's like you have your biological family and then, mm-hmm, when you're queer, you end up having your logical family.
Yeah.
You create a family for yourself. And I've been completely obsessed with Pose. I've been watching Pose. At
right,
the minute,
yeah. I just finished it.
Oh, yeah. My God, yeah. It's just incredible. I sob every episode. But you just see that the way that, how important that is within the community for people to...
And I do think as well that there's something really special about the bond you can have with other queer people somehow, because if you grow up feeling isolated in a conservative community, which many of us have done, and I think you did yourself, then you sort of almost have these kind of secrets to share somehow. There's a kind of intimacy in it.
Well, it's a shorthand. You know each other's sort of journey.
Yeah. Absolutely, and it goes beyond culture, is that what I really like about that story, is that someone in Udo can understand someone in Lahore.
It's not like geographically, there's kind of no
confined
boundary.
It's a very universal story now, and part of the idea of making work and images about it is to add it to the story of the humanities, you know, and not sort of in a separate genre.
Yeah.
I think that is kind of where the culture is headed at the moment, which is a good time to be painting it alive.
Yeah, totally. How did you find art in Pakistan then, where you were from? How did you discover that and what did you see?
So I made friends with a bunch of people who are also artists, and you know, their parents collected art, contemporary artists in Lahore. They had you know, kind of modern Indian artists in their house. So I got to see painting filtered, maybe even like traces of Western painting filtered through to South Asia in that way. And so I did. And because we were very close, I would end up at their house a lot of the times.
Yeah.
And so we would hang out there.
When I was a teenager,
we cared about contemporary artists in a way that, like, you know, most of our school friends were just like, you know, why this is so boring, it's so stupid. You know, this is so rarefied, like, who even cares? And but I think that we were kind of, maybe had like old souls, like we just, you know, I guess we used to have this joke about how we were never really young.
Really?
So, you know, that kind of thing. So
you had a worldliness about you.
Like, we couldn't wait to grow up.
Yeah.
And now now in my mid-30s, I'm like, oh.
I don't want to get any older.
I'm like, middle age.
That's so true, isn't it? I remember being 7 years old and like thinking what it would be like to be 15.
Yeah.
And then there was that song like 16 going on 17.
Yeah.
In Sound of Music, and I was like, wow, when you become 17,
No, I remember being a kid and thinking in the year 2000, I'm going to be 18.
Exactly. Oh my God. Yeah.
And then you're like, right, that's like yonks.
Yeah,
girl.
Yeah. So like, you know, and I guess like the paintings will change as my experience changes.
When did you start painting them?
I started painting when I moved from Lahore to Ohio. Mm-hmm. I did not know very much about American culture before that, apart from the culture that is exported. And so when I went to Ohio, it was kind of like a bit of a shock because like I had only been to maybe New York once on a vacation with my family. Mm-hmm. And so after a year of being confused, moved into a hippie commune for 3 years and that was a whole lot of fun.
And I heard about this because when you went to Ohio as well, you found it quite conservative there, which also you reflected on, you know, the conservatism in Lahore that you'd already experienced, and it was kind of a similar conservatism in a way.
Yes, it was very comforting in the beginning.
Right, interesting.
Oh, it was, because you felt...
Because there were a lot of family values, that, you know, even maybe the biases were just like somehow seemed very familiar to me. Mm. And it was the culture of the younger people that I actually couldn't understand as much because I was coming from a traditional society.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
And
so how did you meet this hippie commune that you then moved into?
There are lots of, because I was taking art classes, I was going to be a painting major. Mm. And that is when I started painting. I did not know very much about oil painting before then.
Like, prior to that, you were drawing?
Drawing.
Sketching.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So how old were you when you began learning about oil paint?
Like 18.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah. So, you know, like not that young, but not that old either, I guess, from a painting point of view.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, like I learned by taking art history classes, and I just became absolutely obsessed with European painting.
Traditional painting,
European painting of the 18th century, the Baroque, early Renaissance, whatever. Like, I wanted to go through all of those stages myself.
Wow.
You know, there were a lot of, like, uncomfortable questions that like came up later. They were just like, you know, but why would you want to do European painting? Why don't you do like something traditional from your culture or whatever? But that didn't really stop me because like it was just I feel like it's a great love of the stories that can be told through oil painting that bring people together, and the sight of like so many paintings telling and like simultaneously telling all the stories of a culture really, really appealed to me. And I wanted to recreate something like that around my own story and similar stories.
And also, I think, isn't there the kind of issue as well of the exclusion of kind of queer men of colour or people of colour in art history anyway? So you're managing to
somehow...
Did
you discover that as you was researching, as you was looking at everything?
Yes, exactly. I mean, some of my friends would say, well, you know, you love Van Dyck, but, you know, Van Dyck might have, like, really awful views about, you know, people from... like, if you were to go back in history, you would see that the people whose skill and, like, whose power of persuasion and pictures that you love, their opinions would be so awful to you, and you know, that is something at one point I had to grapple with. So, you know, I would look this way and that and try to like figure out how to make this work, and like but I really, that didn't, it wasn't persuasive enough for me to stop loving the kind of
style.
Yeah, the style.
Do you feel like you're reasserting your own narrative now in the traditional paintings that should have been there then? Do you feel like you're creating what was missing?
For sure. I really like the idea of a direct narrative. You know, and I work kind of differently from those artists in the sense that all of these pictures are imaginary. So there is no model, there is no, you know, reference apart from my own drawing, which is also imaginary. And so what I... You know, this is their gift to me, in a sense. Like, what I learned from copying the masters for a really long time helped me recreate an imagination that was very vivid I think that it helps people to imagine, to look at the hoards of treasures of pictures and museums.
But you started off learning how to paint figures from life classes, right, in Ohio?
Oh, for sure.
In the hippie commune, people didn't wear a lot of clothes.
Yes,
right?
Yes. So that was great. Like, you know, like I had free models all the time.
And they would let you draw them.
You had like a domestic kind of life model.
Basically. Yeah, life models, lots of beautiful long hair, pastoral ideals. It was, you know, so like it would really kind of bled into the kind of painting that I was looking at. And yeah. I was like, that's great. What a great connection. Even though I think that it was, I guess like superficial at a certain level.
Right.
But even on the surface, it was a very profound connection for me.
Wow. So after Ohio,
yeah.
You came to New York.
I came to New York in 2006. I worked in an office. I did marketing for an art magazine, which has since retired.
Is that your fault? Or?
No, I think it was its own fault. It was selling a space to artists, and I was marketing that space for them. So I had to go through hate mail in the morning and for like, you know, a couple of months that I was working for them. And that's when I decided I was never going to work at a desk, ever. Yeah. I did that for a year, and then I went to Pratt in 2007.
Right. And how was your experience at Pratt? Did that change everything?
It didn't. I mean, in the sense that I was a really stubborn person. I think that it would help me more now if I went there, because I'm a lot more open. At the time, like, I was still stuck in, like, you know, 16, 17. I was just like, I everything should be candlelight and, like, like, I want, like, a plumed hat.
What do you mean, 16th, 17th century?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I was obsessed with the techniques of painting then, how people lived then, what do they wear? Like,
talking about what they wear, that fashion is such a huge theme, motif that runs through your works. The characters are always so well-dressed.
Yeah, they're chosen, like, I really choose items of clothing for the characters, like, they're dolls in a sense. So, you know, like a character can be a bit threadbare. And there are sometimes fashions that I like or already have in my wardrobe. Sometimes fashions that I would like to do but don't have the guts to.
What label? Like, what brands do you like? What labels do you look towards for your characters? They all feel very... they're kind of loosely fitting silks and linens, right. And it's all very natural fibers.
And satin as well.
Satin.
I mean, that's the choice of satin for me is not because of any contemporary brand. It's more, I guess, exploring textures and the way that, in a very traditional way, I guess, like a lot of sumptuous traditional painting has to do with the texture of fur, the texture of satin, like the texture of skin next to it. You can almost feel the temperature in the painting.
There's such an allure, isn't there? And there's like a sensory kind of element when you're looking at your work. Like you can feel like you could reach out and touch that feather boa or something there. Mm. Or you know, like the surface of a bomber jacket.
Right.
Like you can imagine it, how it shines. And
how it feels on
feels,
the skin.
Feels, exactly, yeah.
And so, you know, sometimes the characters have the opposite. Like their, materials may be a bit threadbare, a bit...
So there's a character here with a kind of hole in his knee.
Yeah.
And then stitched up.
Stitched up on the other side, yeah.
Sometimes I use the brush like a pen. Sometimes the brush is used like a brush. And fashion is definitely something that I am attracted to in pictures because when I was doing the very traditional work, I felt like the frivolity of it was fashion was part of that, and I kind of like that. I think it's a moment.
Oh God, yeah, it's very unique to you. It's powerful.
And actually, I think I like the fact that it's not well-known brands. You know, it's not like fashion. If you're thinking of like Gucci or these people, it's not recognizable because it is this imaginary
but
world.
It's also lived in. It feels like the character just sits in the character's...
And like even that guy there who's got like a kind of pink or magenta hat in the middle, like it looks like he's been wearing that hat for a number of years. Do you know what I mean? Like it's his favourite hat or something. Yeah. It doesn't feel like just something brand new or...
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, it's a thrift store find. These are
thrift store.
They're thrift store finds.
So do you ever buy the actual clothing and use them as models?
So no, like I mean, I don't have a plumed hat yet. I'm looking for the right one. I have a hat. But I'm looking for the ostrich feather or whatever.
We're going to find you one.
Or maybe it will find you. Yeah. I believe in things like that. Like it will come into your life at the right time point.
I have wanted to find the right one, but I have not had time in the past 3 months. I've just been in this room for the last 3 months.
You say these are all imaginary scenes, but do you paint from memory, and how autobiographical are some of these? Because there's a painting that's very moving called The Beating, which I've seen recently. Yeah. Could you talk about that?
I was really touched by that work.
Thank you. It was a bit difficult to do that. Like a lot of the work is partially autobiographical and definitely based on memory. And because it's imaginary, it has only to do with the things that I know about. Nothing that I don't know about it's not in the picture, which I like that sort of like automatic editing. That particular picture that you're talking about, The Beating, is based on a memory. And, I wanted to kind of go, not be oblique about it and go straightforward into the narrative. And maybe, in a sense, focus on the peripheries of the image rather than too much in the center of what's actually taking place. So, like, the foliage and the trees and the car. And I feel like that happens in moments of trauma to people. Like, they kind of latch on actually to other details that are not part of... So I was trying to explore that idea.
But this is something you witnessed in Lahore, or...
Yeah.
Right. God.
And it's interesting, this idea, I think, especially in minority groups, often the kind of intolerance and the, you know, for the gay or queer community, kind of homophobia and like racist attacks, or the physical kind of violence, and also even domestic situations of violence, or like sexual assaults or things like that. And for me, what you just described is exactly why the painting touched me so much. And I haven't even seen it in real life.
I
looked at that painting for an hour, like in bed, and I think I wrote to you or wrote a message or something.
Yeah, you did.
Because I was so touched by it. And it's exactly what you're saying. It's that idea of the color of the trees, or the way the trees are blowing in the wind, and the psychology of those tiny
the beating
details
is peripheral to the scene. You know, you because can see it's going on, but you've got the rest of the scene to sort of take your sight away from, because it's too
and also the helplessness,
the
helplessness, not even of the victim, but of the people, like the friend at the door or something, like on the porch, like wanting to help but not being able to help, and this kind of, I don't know, it's just a really powerful work psychologically.
Well, thank you. I mean, there are some things in that work that recur in other paintings. Like, I think the idea of humiliation and passivity is something that happens in the single portraits. There's an inwardness, which can be read as a kind of, I guess, like inward meditation, but also a passive pose, which so that a presentation which is passive, so that it can be judged by whoever is looking at the picture, and putting the viewer maybe in the seat of the gatekeeper, a person, whether the subject should be allowed to pass through a border or not, or like based on what. And so
you're talking about that when Trump's Muslim ban came in, that that affected your work in a big way, right?
Yeah. I mean, I felt, very rarely have I felt like personally attacked by world politics.
Because you're Muslim, yeah?
I was raised Muslim.
Right.
I mean, I think that the rest of it is like maybe debatable. But... So, yeah, I mean, I was already planning to do this work. It just gave the work more meaning to me.
More kind of urgency.
Urgency to put it out in the culture. And the response was also an urgently positive one. Mm. Yeah.
Because you have these characters, and they're like a queer bohemia. Mm-hmm. And... you would assume that they were Muslim, some of them. And when this Trump Muslim ban came in, the characters are kind of like quaffing back martinis, like, fuck it.
Yeah.
This is what it is.
Yeah.
We're here. it's not, no, we're not going anywhere. We're here, we're queer, yeah. and we're going to have a good time.
Yeah.
And it feels like they're all really yeah. learned and very, there's a vulnerability, and right. there's a, but there's also a lot of power in
yeah,
your...
Yeah, totally. And right. and the word I that really struck me that I've heard you mention before is dignity. And the sense of dignity mm-hmm. and strength from that.
Yeah, dignity and glamour through a knowledge and a love for the arts, which always goes across borders and cultures. Mm. You know, that's something that I like to imbue a lot of the characters with, because I think my own life is like that. My friends are all into it. And so... there is an oscillation between the power that that brings, the sense of power that that brings, and sense of beauty, and also a kind of passivity, I guess, in mm-hmm. the face of, or even humiliation in the face of maybe events that are out of your control, or mm-hmm. like all the necessary judging of people crossing borders and mm-hmm. how that works.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the effects of that encounter?
Mm-hmm.
A reduction of the self to yeah. basic sort of
the humanity
documents,
of it, yeah.
scholars. So I think some of the pictures try to investigate what that means, and what the inside maybe feels like. It's an inner self-portrait, I guess. It's not something yeah, that actually looks like me.
But they're very interior.
Yeah.
I mean, these people have, yeah. you can read them. You know what they're thinking.
And actually, like, if you have that idea of being at a border
yeah.
and
yeah.
you're being checked and you have to
check.
Open up your bag or your suitcase and then lay out all of your belongings
from inside. Take off your belt and take off
exactly.
your shoes.
Yeah. You know, we all might have experienced things like that in yeah. very small ways,
yeah.
you know, from like going through, mm-hmm. you know, security checks or all that yeah. kind of stuff mm-hmm. in airports or whatever. But there's something so kind of really, it just gets me in the gut. It's like...
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a kind of like it's a reading of self. But I definitely want to point out that it's not like a criticism of the process, because the people doing it are doing their job, and their
yeah,
job
yeah,
is
yeah,
pretty
of course.
Frustrating. But yeah. Having said that, I... also want to stress that encounter really leaves an inner self-portrait inside the people crossing, and even who get to the other side.
Yes.
And in some of these pictures, I wanted to get, you know, like maybe have the viewer make an uncomfortable decision between two different, slightly different people of color.
Mm.
You know, maybe one is luckily threadbare, one has a beard, the other one doesn't, the other one looks maybe more westernized.
Mm-hmm.
And so those decisions, you know, become so heavy.
Do you feel a responsibility when you make them now?
When I make these
paintings,
images?
Like, do you feel a responsibility to like the narrative that you're telling?
I feel a responsibility to myself, and so in the sense that I try not to represent anyone but myself.
Got it.
Because I feel like otherwise it can get dangerous really quickly,
mm-hmm.
And also it's only meaningful when the pictures come from a personal, a very private place.
Yeah.
And in the process, I end up making myself a little bit vulnerable.
Is that a good thing though, for you to feel vulnerable when you're making the work? Do you feel like it's successful then?
Yeah, I mean, plus in the studio it is. Time will tell what that means. Like in the world, I know in the studio it's really rewarding, because it gives it brings a lot of pleasure and meaning.
Mm.
Because there is a sense that this is real, or like this is coming from a very, very real place, and it's going to it exists in the world now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Art, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
Yes. Yeah. So talking about your studio practice, mm-hmm. you've got the Whitney Show coming up, so you've yes. got the pressure of that and you're making work. But how often do you come to studio, and how long does it take for you to create work?
So I only work at on one painting at a time, right. and never multiple. So it's a completely emotional attachment. I am kind of a workaholic. If I don't paint for too long, I become cranky. So I don't go on holiday for like more than 10 days.
Really? So you have to be making?
I have to be making.
But you'll so take a like sketchbook with you on holiday?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm going to like, let's say if I'm going to like a country where there are like great museums, I'll stay there for a month. But if it's a beach holiday, I can't do it for more than 10 days.
Love that.
Yeah. So need to consume culture, like especially in the form of pictures and historical pictures, if you will.
So a painting would take you how long normally then if you're working on one at a
completely
time?
Completely random. Sometimes it's a large painting can come out really smoothly, and there are no sort of editing, very few edits. And you know, whenever that happens, I just feel like, wow, I can just, like, now I can do anything, really. Like, I've really got the handle on this now. And yet now, you know, like, I know that that's not true because I do the next thing and it's like, it's totally like starting from scratch. I always run into problems that I didn't foresee. And
Like what?
Like, for instance, like a lot of these, the faces on the characters have been changed at least 3-4 times, every single one of them. Like, there's usually like a face underneath the face on top because it has to be the right one.
So when they x-ray your paintings like the old masters back in the day, they're going to see all your workings underneath.
They will find. And sometimes the paint is really thick, so you can actually see the face underneath because like the paint was very thick under the latest layer.
Mm-hmm.
But I spend the whole day painting, so I'm done usually by 6-7. Then I meet my friends for drinks and dinner. Always.
And natural light, or do you like working with strip lights you've got in here, or...?
I like working with tube lights.
You do?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
See, that surprises me because I read that you loved lamps and obviously candlelight sort of within the work. Like, you kind of had a passion for this idea of that kind of lighting. Yeah. But then I guess for actually the practicality of making, you need a different kind of light.
For sure. Like at home, for instance, like if someone turns on like the overhead light, I actually like give a screech.
I do too.
Like, oh my God.
Like, it really resonated with me when I heard that.
It's awful.
It's awful.
I'm just like, oh my God, no, please turn that off. It's just... You know, like that. I only turn that on for like 5 seconds if I'm looking for something.
Yeah, like, you've lost your keys or your wallet. Yeah.
Trying to find your passport. To find your keys.
Yeah.
So you just mentioned editing.
Yeah.
And that really resonates with me because these film like feel like film stills to me.
Mm-hmm.
Does film ever play into your creating?
Probably because I am a huge soundtrack consumer. So like
a film soundtrack.
Mm-hmm,
Interesting because you can. You can feel sound.
Yeah,
in these
I love horror movie soundtracks, especially.
Really?
Horror movie?
Yeah, I think like the Shining soundtrack is great.
When you listen to that while you're working?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, but the Shining soundtrack is like actually kind of like a really dark, like, bark number. It is kind of, it's a very, it's great for painting.
So that must really affect the work.
Yeah.
So do you find when you listen to like horror movie ones, you're going to the darker psyche of yourself and exploring that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, I was listening to a horror soundtrack, especially when I was doing this. I thought it really worked for me.
A kind of supernatural vibe, though, in them. There's a kind of like green light a lot
like
of the
ghosts.
Time.
They're ghostly at times, aren't they?
Right. And
they're
it is,
into the background. Are they there? Are they not there? Are they witnessing from the past or are they present?
We met Cheyenne Julien the other night in the Bronx, and I was talking to her about this idea of light in her paintings. Mm. And when I was looking at yours, I was like, well, you also have this really unusual kind of light and twilight and kind of like, it's like an in-between time. It's like a time that you can't quite capture.
Totally. I totally respond to her paintings.
Really?
Some of them. That have like sort of light coming in when this like girl is lying in bed. I absolutely love those paintings. So the idea of light is very close to me. There's something kind of ethereal, kind of poisonous, kind of glamorous about green. It was a completely aesthetic choice that I kind of chanced on maybe a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. There is a painting at Marianne Boesky on right now. Yes. That was the first green painting that I ever did. And
no.
Yeah. So that was that. All the rest of them are trying to like
and
attempt
so
to be as
have
good
such
as that.
A visual, a visceral feeling when they look at that.
Yeah.
But I went there and it was.
I often find green paintings generally quite challenging. I don't always enjoy the experience of looking at green paintings. And actually, personally, like red as well. I find red paintings really. I don't know what that's
does
about.
Green feature
but
in
your
traditional
green
painting
work
you've
I
like
connect to
brought that from.
So green does feature in traditional painting, not in such a poisonous degree, but like more sort of like green umber. It's a very, very common kind of background color for most European paintings. Uh-huh. As for portraits and for paintings of like almost all dark areas in European paintings are kind of done with olive green or raw umber. And those are very, very greenish hues. But I was thinking more of a modern, slightly more kind of absinthe-based green. And there was also a little bit like Slytherin-ish
Slytherin, Harry Potter references though.
Your figures in the work have such a unique physicality, and they often kind of like almost bend. It's like they're melting. Like you talk about candlelight and you think about candles melting. Yeah. Like if you look at these figures here, they're almost like these masks that are kind of somehow like melting, like the noses and the...
But that's quite macabre because there's a severed head in that one as well, what we're looking at, right?
Yeah.
Was that the Shining soundtrack?
No, this one required no soundtrack because it was one of the very quick ones.
Where does this come from, this kind of physicality? Because it makes me think a lot of dance as well.
For sure. I feel like I'm dancing in my head.
Do you?
Yeah. And I love dancing anyway. Okay. So.
Are you a good dancer?
I think so.
Yeah. And what kind of dance? Yeah. when you say you like to dance, what do you mean? Like going to a club, or do you mean more like ballet, or what kind of dance?
I mean, sort of like club bob dancing, but like more not in a club because I don't really go dancing in clubs. There are a few bars where you can dance.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You prefer to dance in a bar?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
On the bar?
No, I don't think it's gone that far. But I like dancing.
And so do you have a relationship with like classical dance, like ballet? Or
I don't. No, you don't, I've never been trained. I don't follow it as much, but yeah.
And what about things like opera? Do you like opera or not?
No.
No, okay, it's interesting.
Yeah. So you've been quoted as saying you like to paint sissies.
Yeah.
You like to paint kind of more effeminate men. For you are a subject that really inspired. What is it about the effeminate man that inspires you in art?
I think it's I hope that it's a kind of an endearing character. That's where kind of like the slouch comes from. I like that things don't look like people don't look like they're strong enough. They're sort of like these slouchy losers.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Is that playing to vulnerability again?
Yeah. Because like that comes from the experience of going to school, you know, in a very macho atmosphere not being at all macho myself.
Yeah.
Eventually finding a community of people like myself. But I feel like it's an important story to tell because the nature of the masculine is now changing. And so it's a very good time to be telling that story.
There's also this idea of dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at a lot of them, they often have their like hands on their faces. They're sort of daydreaming or thinking. But also this idea of the intellectual and the kind of literary or something, like the idea that they're probably like lost in a book.
Right.
And I noticed that talking about the things of like femininity within the male, or even just kind of camp, say. Mm-hmm. I noticed that in some of your paintings where you've had like floating shelf paintings, you have the books of Susan Sontag, who obviously wrote Notes on Camp.
Right, yeah.
And can you talk a bit about your relationship to her writing and poetry and also why you like to paint the actual book covers?
Well, it's like you want to make the characters academic. They're learned, they're academic, they're not stupid. They're highly intelligent.
Knowledgeable.
And they feel like they've got wealth, they've got money, they can support themselves, so they can have a really lovely social life.
Right, yeah.
And so them sort of references play into that theme, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like the consumption, like consuming intellectual literature deliciously. And like books really, you know, turn me on that way. And
you a big reader?
Yeah, I like fiction.
Do you write?
Nonfiction. I am working on a graphic novel, so let's see.
Good. Well, I feel like you can write, because I want to see the movie of these characters.
Yeah,
I feel like you can write.
The graphic novel is kind of about this stuff.
Is it? Oh,
yeah.
Fantastic. Look forward to that.
Why someone like Susan Sontag?
Oh, I just love how regal she was, and you know, just bored, and you know, when I was as a teenager, just over her photographs from the 70s, her essays, I guess like she, because even especially at that time, she gave power to ways of thinking and being that had no cultural resonance otherwise outside the world of academia. But inside it, I feel like there was a lot of dignity and power and glamour. And like it was, and so me and my friend sort of lived inside that world. And there was a kind of a little scene that is equivalent to that way of thinking, even in Pakistan. So, yeah.
They all feel like they're part of the same book club. Do you know what I mean? They all share the same books and they get together and have a salon and discuss.
That's
beautiful. So there's a lot of motifs that come up in your work a lot. We see the smartphone.
Yeah.
It's a traditional painting style, but then we see the smartphone. Mm-hmm. We see Netflix.
Yes.
We see like Grindr hookups. Right. I think there's one called The Arrival. And before I really realised, I thought, well, it looks quite ominous.
Right.
And he realised he's opening the door to a hookup, right?
I was thinking of ominous.
Oh, you was? Okay.
I was.
What about an ominous hookup?
I mean, yeah. I mean, it could be a hookup. It could be anything, really. But I was thinking of something, I guess, not pun intended, but biblical. Like the prodigal son or something. Like some story.
Oh, right.
Like, because there are lots of... I just love the idea of someone arriving or leaving through a portal. And, like, I just wanted to get into the emotional part of that. Which is why I think the person who's arriving looks maybe a little too Jesus-y.
No, I love it. Well, that's why, though, I see.
So right, it was right. Like, you know, it was a kind of emotional goodbye or arrival. I ended up calling it arrival, but it could equally have been a goodbye. So, yeah, that's where that came from.
And a lot of those works are interior spaces, so they're kind of private spaces. And you definitely get that sense of kind of... the intimacy of the friendship and the gossipy kind of, or even confessional or somehow a sadness, like they might be, you know, exploring some deep trauma or grief. Mm-hmm. And then you get that very close, you know, the closeness of the figures with each other, or even like a YouTube moment where they might be playing a song and about to dance to a YouTube
or
song.
Or showing videos to each other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that kind of safe space. Mm-hmm. And was that a concern of yours that you deliberately chose to paint those spaces, or is it just an automatic thing that happens?
It was automatic in the beginning that I was painting. I was kind of like in a, you know, interior decorating these spaces, if you will. I would just paint them. Sometimes they would look like my apartment. Sometimes I would add like pieces of furniture that I would like to have, like thrifty, kind of shabby chic. And
Shaker style there is like.
The right. So like it's just kind of threadbare and fun. There was a real need for coziness. And it took me like a while, like once I had gathered a few images like that, that I realized that I was doing these for a deeper reason. And that was that I liked the safeness of them.
Right.
And that they were safe spaces. And
Nostalgic, sort of the familiarism of them.
And do they make you feel safe then?
For sure. They make me happy. I think that for me, painting is definitely a way of summoning things that make me happy most of the time.
Wow.
It's a way of summoning, and it truly was actually a way of, art was a way of summoning my friendships, which have been, you know, that's so important to me in my life.
Well, you're talking about friendships now. You're part of like a really tight squad that are really covering queer intimism in art at the moment. Mm-hmm. There's you, there's Doran Langberg, there's Louis Fratino, who we've interviewed. What does that feel like to be part of this kind of really important trailblazing moment?
I feel so lucky, so grateful, because, I mean, it's just incredible, I guess. Daron is also a friend, you know, I love his work. I love that there's someone
to
talk
about.
Yeah, he has. That was like a spur of the moment thing at his studio. I never thought that it would end up in a show, I'm glad that it is.
Yeah.
And it's great.
And what other artists do you look to? Because I heard that you love Kerry James Marshall's work.
Yeah, that was because in 2006, when I had moved to New York from Ohio, there were very few figurative artists and also people of color working in the figurative world. Mm. There was Kerry James Marshall, there was Nicole Eisenman, Kehinde Wiley, and a few others. And so those were the people, those were the only people that one could look at that time.
Mm. Right.
And so there was, when I saw his work, it was a great understanding of how to of creating pictures
creating scenes,
how to create pictures and how people consume really pictures to do with people of color in this culture.
Right. And are you a big like art fan in the sense, do you often like seek out exhibitions and try and see a lot, or do you just try and stay quite solitary?
I don't go to Chelsea all that much. There are a few artists that I go for, and they're part of the group that you mentioned. And otherwise, like, you know, any kind of like big figurative show, I'll go and see. Yeah,
when I've described your work to people, I've said it's like the South Asian John Curran. How do you feel about that reference? Can I keep saying that?
I was kind of shocked when you said John Curran, though, because I feel like his work is so much more sexualized.
The painterly effect somehow. Of it. I'm not thinking about the subjects. Itself. Yeah, I'm thinking I think about the painterly effect
for sure. Like and that's obviously he's one of the other artists that I looked at a lot because he's an incredible painter.
Yeah,
You know, like I think subject-wise, like it's totally different.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's painting like sexualized women, and you know he's a straight white man, so that's quite a different approach.
I'll stop that then. I'll stop you to that. But
talking about other influences on your wall here, you have like postcards and pictures stuck up. You've got like almost like you pinned them to the wall.
Yeah.
So what is that all about? Is that to have kind of history, kind of moments of history there, so you can.
Yeah, there are either random postcards or artists whose work I really like. This is a
Isn't that Arshia Gorky there?
Yes,
I love that painting.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I picked out this little Balthus one from the MoMA. It's a large kind of street scene that he did, and I'm just obsessed with it. I just love looking at it, And, you
because
know,
the characters are facing away from you, so you're seeing people's backs and their profiles rather than like a formal setup, like a portrait.
Oh, that's very important to me in my painting. I really like that people are involved, like in the scene, that the narrative,
movement.
And they're involved with each other. And there is no, there are maybe one or two pictures in which people actually look out. There's no otherwise an engagement.
If they're facing forward, they're normally looking down, aren't they? Or sideways,
yeah. It's not about engaging.
Yeah. Do you think of your audience when you make work?
It's been a bit of a challenge to throw that off, to not think about that because there's a show coming up. But otherwise, when I'm working, I'm totally convinced that this is like playtime and this is not really, it has to be fun and it has to be totally for myself. And I can be pretty hard on myself in the sense that it's not every painting is acceptable to me, so that I finish.
How do you know when a painting's done?
It's a million-dollar question.
I think it's like an intuitive thing. I know it's done. And when it's not going according to plan, it's very hard for me to abandon it, and I get really feisty for days if it's not like I'm just in a bad mood if it's not going when it's hard to control paint, and it's not always fun, you know. It's like a partnership. It's like having, I'm not gonna say a mistress, a partner. So it is an emotional relationship. I totally I spend myself on these.
One
images.
More thing I just wanted to mention was, you know, you started to paint sort of exterior scenes. Mm-hmm. So often the location, I'll look at it and I'll be like, it feels familiar, but it feels completely not familiar. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a bit about that and how you construct the cities in your imaginary world that you've created?
The kind of link between the past and where you are now and where you've come from.
Like, because they feel like different locations in one location.
Right. I mean, I hope that like sort of hanging side by side, that they speak to one another, and that by sometimes like merging them together, I can bring these two cultures that are otherwise considered to be very far off from each other into one kind of context and one larger
story. So you have
story.
Like a street in Lahore with a street in the East Village.
Right, yeah.
And then that merging them into experience. One place. Yeah, exactly.
That is part of my experience, and that's not, I feel like, Americans could maybe benefit from knowing that story and to make to be able to know that you can make those connections which seem so really out of the way.
You're creating your bohemia with all of your
experiences.
You are.
And also it's a kind of like indifference, there is also similarities and that we all have common struggles or commonalities between us. So you can connect people like in a way.
Yeah,
through the work. Yeah.
So we ask every guest that comes on two very important questions. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, your touchstone artwork, you can steal it, you can live with it forever.
And we can help you, we can get you a crane or a helicopter or anything you need.
Forklift truck.
Okay, so there isn't an artwork. There is an artist that I would steal from the National Gallery.
Really?
In London.
Yes.
I would take away all the Pontormos that they have.
The what?
The Pontormos.
Pontormos?
He's a mannerist artist from Italy.
And what's a mannerist artist? Yeah. What is that?
A mannerist artist is it's kind of like a curdling of the knowledge that was gained during the Renaissance of picture making and various classical poses. And so a generation mastered those, and then the next generation was so used to the poses that they sort of started overdoing them in a way that, like, you know, people looked like, you know, they couldn't walk across a room because, like,
they were so bendy.
Anatomy was like, so it was like they're made out of wax. So, and the touch in those paintings is so delicate that I would like to bring them back to my studio and look at them for like a month and then give them back.
Wow, because I was nervous for a minute. You meant like remove them because you didn't want them to be seen.
Oh, no.
But you want to take them because you love them.
Oh, no, I absolutely love them.
Oh, I see, great.
I absolutely.
So when you go to
them.
London, do you go there and sort of see them as a touchstone? Do you go and stand in front of them?
Oh, for sure. Like I go to the Dulwich Gallery a lot. I go to
the Dulwich Picture Gallery.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
It's such a fit. I mean, I absolutely love it.
Could you ever imagine yourself working in London or in the UK?
I'll have a gallery there, I think.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah. You might be having a gallery there.
Might be. Yeah.
Awesome. So right, how do you feel about all that as well? Because that's all a new thing for you.
Yeah, so what's happening now with you? So you've got the Whitney show coming up, which is a big deal. Yeah. So what happens with like finding a gallerist and stuff?
Yeah, it's really funny for me because like I'm doing this show without a gallery. And that's not usually what happens. You don't get a museum show before you get a gallery.
How did you get this museum show?
It was both of the curators, Chris Liu and Ambika Trasi, were following my work since 2015. And they had been dropping by the studio every now and then. And we got along fabulously. We had a great time every time. But I wasn't really sure what was happening. Like, so until the last time they showed up, they were like, what do you like at the end of our meeting? They're just like, well, how do you feel about our show? But it would have to be really soon. And so, you know, at first I had a panic attack. I was like, oh my God, like I can't make so much work in this little, very little time. But then I was like, I'll do something. And then I asked them if I could dance a little bit.
So what performance art?
Like dance because I was just like, is this really happening?
Right. In front of this, you had a little dance in front of them.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So
they were just like, oh yeah, they were just like, dance away. And
that's,
I was like,
so cute. So
just like one of your paintings.
Yeah.
I love that.
Wow. So then, so you're hoping then with the show, obviously you're going to get representation in the States and.
Yeah.
Because you have representation in India, right?
Yeah, now I do.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And how was your work received there?
With heaps of love.
Really?
Because like I was in Pakistan when that was going on. I couldn't go to India because it's because I have a Pakistani background. It's not possible to go to India. And so I was across the border and the protests were happening in Delhi. And a lot of people were going from the protests to the show.
What?
or
like... Wow.
Yeah, so like I would see like their Instagram stories and they were at the protest and they would go to the show that then would go back to the protests. And the dominant narrative was of a lot of anxiety and hate from both sides of the border, it was just surreal to get so much support and love from the other side.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
The other question, not the other answer, the other question we ask every guest is, what is your favorite color?
Green.
We're currently sat in the studio where almost every painting has green in it.
Yeah, my hoodie's green, my paintings are green. Oh my God.
And why, like, green?
I think it's just, I mean, it's going to be a cliche answer. It's very peaceful.
It's nature. Is it nature or?
Yeah, I love nature. And it's also it's a twofold color for me. On the one hand, it's very peaceful. And on the other hand, it's just something of a glamorous and a poisonous invitation in green, which I really like.
I know the word poisonous, I had never thought of really, and it was such an interesting thing to hear you talk about.
Well, it makes me think of absinthe. Yeah. It makes me think of the green fairy.
Yeah,
it
makes
me think
fairy.
Of old school Hollywood movies, right. Kind of like something Bette Davies would have worn.
It's making me think of Kylie Minogue because she played the absinthe fairy in Moulin Rouge.
Love a bit of Kylie. You do. Well, this has been incredible. We wish you all the luck for the Whitney. When do you open?
It opens on March 20th.
And how long is it running for?
Until July 5th.
Cool. And will you get a publication, do you think?
I don't think so. I don't think there's a catalogue that goes with it.
Okay.
Yeah. The good news is I'm going to come back and I'll get to see it.
Yes, yes, please do.
I'm going to come back to
and
New York.
Instagram. Instagram plays a big part in your work, right? In putting your...
Yes. I don't think I would exist without Instagram. So thank you, Instagram.
With the world.
Yeah. What is your Instagram?
My Instagram is salman.tour.
So for everybody listening, we're going to post images of many of Salman's works at our Instagram, which is at TalkArt, or you can follow him at salman.tour. And we will be back very soon. Thank you for inviting us into your private safe space. We're incredibly grateful and looking forward to seeing you in the Whitney.
Thank you.
Lots of love, everyone. We'll be back soon. Okay, bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.